on this episode of Rebel Spirit Radio.
Of course, the thigh bone is a representation of the star constellation that circulates the whole star. Okay, so you see it like the Egyptian opening of the mouth ritual, by which they make something divine, utilizes an implement in that shape. The plow, the distinctive shape of the constellation. So that then becomes a symbol of eternity, because it's always visible. And then you see Mithras wielding that in one of the scenes connected with the Tarotan. So this notion of eternal life is kind of encoded within it. And we're also now at the kind of issue of what exactly or how exactly did this astral religion become such a defining feature of so many cultures across the world? You know, it's like certain portions of the night sky have become indelibly stamped with a certain metaphysical and spiritual understanding.
Welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio, exploring the frontiers of spirituality, consciousness, the esoteric, and humanity's sacred relationship with a living earth. I'm your host, Nick Mather, and in this episode, I am joined by author Peter Mark Adams to discuss his latest book, Ritual and Epiphany in the Mysteries of Mithras. We discuss various aspects of mystery cults, focusing on the Mithraic mysteries and their iconography. The discussion also covers the resurgence of Hellenistic esoteric practices during the Renaissance, and Adams shares insights about the mysteries of initiation, the role of virtue, and the intersection of philosophy, spirituality, and power. Also, please be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. Your support is truly appreciated. Okay, I'll do that. I have a little bit of a ritual where I always burn incense in my interviews. And normally I do Palo Santo, but for some reason I thought that burning frankincense and myrrh would be more appropriate for this conversation. And so I've got a incense thing with charcoal over here, and I'm trying to be mindful of it because I also don't want to set off the fire alarms, which I have done. So that said, hopefully I can manage both things and not set off the alarms. All right. Peter Mark Adams is an author, poet, and essayist specializing in the ethnography of ritual, sacred spaces, esotericism, consciousness, and healing. A philosophy graduate, Peter pursues advanced studies in iconology, iconography, Renaissance art, and material culture with the Warburg Institute School of Advanced Studies, and studies of Middle Egyptian tomb and temple text with former Yale associate professor Dr. Colleen Darnell. Peter is an associate member of the European Society for the Study of Western Esotericism. He is the author of several books, including The Game of Saturn, Decoding the Sola Busca Teruki, Mistai, Dancing Out the Mysteries of Dionysus, and the Hagia Sophia, Sanctum of Kronos, Spiritual Descent in an Age of Tyranny. He joins me today to discuss his latest book, Ritual and Epiphany in the Mysteries of Mithras, an Imperial Roman Recension of the Cult of the Time Deity. Peter, welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio.
Thank you for inviting me on, Nick.
Yes, of course. I am very excited to speak with you. As I noted, I'm a fan of your work. I read The Game of Saturn a while back, and I reread it for preparation for this. I also have a copy of Mistai, but I've not read that one yet, but it's definitely on my list. I have an abiding interest in the Dionysian mysteries and mystery traditions in general.
Yeah.
So it's really an honor for me to be able to speak to you today. So I really appreciate your time. So, and all apologies for any kind of slaughtering I did of pronunciations in the intro there. I don't know why my tongue is not working this morning. I think maybe the coffee hasn't quite kicked in yet. But I thought that a good place to begin would be to ask you just kind of generally about the mystery traditions. I'm aware of them, and I'm sure that some of my audience are familiar with the idea of the mystery traditions, but I don't want to assume that everyone is. So I thought that we could begin just with a sort of a general
understanding of what mystery traditions are, and then we can start getting into some of the specifics about the Mithraic cult or Mithraic mysteries.
Yeah, sure. That's a huge question, actually, because my research indicates that what we call the mysteries are normally thought to be located in the classical Greco-Roman world, or possibly including Egypt. But actually, it looks like a far more pervasive human cultural phenomenon than just the classical world. And specifically, south of Izmir, there's a range of mountains. And amongst the rock shelters there, you can see the cave art. It's dating back to around, I don't know, 7,000 BC, 6,000 BC, somewhere around there. And it clearly depicts a group of ritualists gathered around a large deity. And the interesting thing is the ritualists are assuming the form and shape of the deity. And this kind of, in essence, summarizes the spiritual import of the mystery cults. It introduced the initiate to a deity and allowed them to become, using the parlance of another culture, possessed by the deity. So what we're actually talking about is a merger of human awareness with that of a higher order being, a multidimensional entity or being. And that's the essence of a mystery cult. They were always designated the mysteries of, rather than generically. So it was right. Always the mysteries of Dionysus, or the mysteries of Demeter, or the daughter, Persephone. The generic world comes into place with Mircea Eliade, who identified in a more contemporary context of the 50s and 60s what he called rites of initiation in the higher religion, so that it has a sound ethnographic basis cross-culturally. And of course, I guess as most of us know, cults of possession are like the foundation stone of human spiritual evolution. Okay, so you can probably trace them back to the Upper Paleolithic, if we're reading some of the rock art from that era correctly. So I tend to think of the mysteries, therefore, as this huge continuum of human spiritual aspiration and evolution. And it was only in the classical era that it reached a high degree of refinement in the West, before that was kind of stamped out by the church. But in the East, of course, it's continued. It's the Vajrayana tradition, the Indo-Tibetan Higher Yoga Tantra, is a mystery practice in its essence, the merging of the initiate awareness with that of a deity, a specific deity, Kuru Kulu, Kala Chakra. There are any number of manifestations of the supreme that become a channel towards this merger, which is essentially a state of non-dual awareness. That's what we're talking about. It's like sits at the crown of human spiritual achievement. So that's kind of the short answer there.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Yeah, I think it's helpful. I began, in my educational process, the first ones that I learned about were the rites of Eleusis, with Demeter and Persephone, and then Dionysus, and then eventually Bres. But let me ask you this, because I think if I understand what you wrote in the book, I think you have a kind of an interesting take on this, because I wanted to ask you, well, why are these referred to as mysteries? And I learned initially that it was because you were initiates, to use that language, were forbidden from speaking about them, that what went on had to be kept secret. And because of that, we, in the 21st century and in the 20th century, what was going on was kind of a mystery to us. But if I understand correctly, what you add to this is this another part to this idea of mystery, which is not just that what was going on had to be kept secret, but that what was experienced itself couldn't be spoken, that it was an ineffable experience.
Exactly so, yeah. And that's a recurrent, it's kind of fixed in the Greek language and the two words that one is, as you say, not to be spoken, and the other one is unspeakable, you can't find words for it. So again, it strongly underlines to me, when I combined with the iconography, for instance, that we're talking about states of non-dual awareness that exceed rational, or our ability to grasp rationally.
And what you've done, and I want to ask about Mithras specifically, but sort of just generally, the approach that you took in your latest book, The Mysteries of Mithras, was that, or excuse me, Ritual and Epiphany in the Mysteries of Mithras, was you focused on the iconography in an attempt to understand what the initiate was going through, what their experience might have been, because we don't have very many texts, if any, really. I think there are some, like fragments here and there about what was going on in the Mithraic mysteries. So what you're doing is you're kind of focusing on the cult iconography. And I want to get into that, but I just want to try to clarify the approach before we get into a lot of the details.
I mean, there is some text. Plutarch has written in a commentary on the symbolism of the Mithraic mysteries in his On the Cave of the Nymphs. A lot of scholars have a problem with that. They think it's a Neoplatonic kind of late overlay. But as I've sought to demonstrate in the book, the iconography of Mithraism is exclusively Orphic. There's no original iconography in it that cannot be traced back to Orphic texts, the Orphic fragments. Okay, so that's a link. So we have Porphyry's commentary, and that's kind of backed up by the fact that Plotinus, his teacher, was teaching in Rome for like 25 years, and had the Roman emperor and his wife as very close friends, and he was therefore teaching to imperial circles and aristocrats with a profound interest in esotericism and esoteric doctrine. And after his death, Porphyry pretty much picked up where he had left off. So if anyone was in a position in the second and third centuries to have a real insight into what it was that made Mithraism so important, it would be Porphyry. So, I mean, the context in which he wrote, for me, gives a distinct positive spin to on his commentary on the Caves of the Nymphs. So we have a good grasp of metaphysics there, and the metaphysics he outlines lines up with the kind of Orphism that we know, for example, from Plato's Phaedrus, which is like a classical account of what Orphic doctrine is. Especially like using the Stephanus numbers 243 to 249, pretty well encompasses the Orphic, the gamut of Orphic key principles. So we have that. Also, we have some very, critical comments by some of the church fathers. Of course, they were only too eager to put the boot into Orphism, into Mithraism. So we can glean a few bits and pieces from that. But yeah, apart from that, the cult disappeared around the 5th century, 6th century, and didn't reappear again for 1,000 years. So essentially, it was the recovery of Rome's legacy in like 13th, 14th century, the first Renaissance, in which they recovered the Latin cultural inheritance. And as part of that, they did a lot of excavations were going on. Of course, they were not what we would call archaeological. Let's be kind about it. But yeah, they recovered a huge amount of material, because the Mithraic chapels were often underneath churches. So they were literally the basement structure, which is exactly where you find it, San Clemente in Rome. You go through church, and it's got these amazing frescoes by Giotto and everything. And then you go down two floors, and there's a Mithraic temple there, fully functional.
Yeah, and I remember hearing that many, many years ago that a lot of the churches were built on former pagan sites. And so what you're saying is that not definitely not all of them, but many of them were built on the Mithraeums.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Often than they see crosses cut into Mithraic statues and so on to kind of
Yeah.
defuse the spiritual charge.
Ah, okay.
So,
Yeah.
they would actually carve a little cross on them, which was a common practice in antiquity to
Right.
defuse pagan spiritual current running through them,
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and Christianity borrowed a lot, not just in the iconography. I don't know where it was. It was in one of the catacombs somewhere, but I know that there's a image of a man, I think with like a lamb or a sheep he's kind of carrying. And a lot of people would assume, well, that's a reference to Christ, but it wasn't. It was a reference to, I don't want to say Orpheus, but maybe. But it was definitely not a Christian symbol. It was more of a pagan symbol that got co-opted by early
I think
Christianity.
there has been a lot of attempts to assimilate Christianity and Mithraism and then
Yeah.
to ask the question, had events turned out different, could Mithraism have been the predominant religion in the West? But I want to point out that Mithraism was a secret cult.
Right.
The Mithraea themselves were not part of Roman state religion.
Right.
They were privately sponsored. And given the nature of the Roman organization, that's to say, it was based on the family and the clan and the tribe and so on, a sponsor with a deep interest in esotericism would tend to have close relatives or family members in the Mithraea with them. Okay. They never proselytized. This is the important thing. It was closed, a closed cult. So unless you were invited, certainly on the frontiers, they would lose people regularly. And what we're seeing in the record is a steady replacement of people who've disappeared. But we never see a sudden expansion unless there's been a major battle or the plague. And again, they're reconstituting a certain number. Typically, it would be 10 people or 30 people would be a really large Mithraea. No doubt in Rome, they could be bigger than that around the imperial court, but out in the frontiers of the empire, they were quite small affairs. Like on Hadrian's Wall, it was tiny little Mithraea there. But it has all of the iconography. I mean, this is the other incredible thing. The consistency of iconographic representation from one end of the empire to the other is incredibly uniform. And it makes sense because this was an age where maybe 3-4% of the population were literate. The rest of
And
the population, 97%, were illiterate, so you had to communicate through image.
right. Well, and that's similar to how the early church did it with the imagery and, like stained glass windows and whatnot. And so my understanding is that those who were most likely in the Mithraic cult were, you always hear that it's the Roman soldiers, but I think you also noted that it was the elite as well.
I think it started in Rome with the elite and the
Okay.
transfer of the initiatory lineage from the Armenian royal family to Nero's and his circle. And that marked a very specific, I mean, the deity had always, so to see, say, supervised treaties, agreements, contracts.
Right.
Just, right back to the Bronze Age, this has been a characteristic of this deity. So it tended to be of special interest to the leaders of any community who would normally be the deal makers and breakers, of course.
Yeah.
So the attempt to settle the Eastern question between Rome and the Sasanians fell on Armenia. And so the agreement was a Armenian or Sasanian prince would rule it, but they would be confirmed in their rulership by Rome. So it was in that context that the ruler Tiridates brought the cult to Rome, to Nero's court. And I'm thinking if Nero subscribed to the cult, which the evidence suggests that he did, then his circle would also have joined the cult. And with that, you have a very powerful nucleus of shaping individuals who could then influence the governors and then the heads of the legions. And so you get a natural dispersal from Rome on the back of major appointments. So that's why we have this like uniform spread from one end of the empire to the other, which is difficult to account for otherwise, since the cult wasn't part of Rome's religion.
Right. Yeah, and I think it's important to remember that, as you pointed out, that it spread, that it was Hadrian's Wall. I visited a Mithraeum in London when I was there. Happened to do it on the winter solstice, which I thought was very
Well
appropriate.
done.
I thought it was very appropriate. They did not have the Toronomy there, though. They have this. I think it was on display somewhere else. I don't know why they would have removed it, but they had
Well, they've
this
made
like
a kind of
cool.
glass one now.
Yeah, that's exactly what it
So it gets
was. Yeah.
illuminated with the light show and everything. I don't think they have a real one from that site.
Okay, yeah. I didn't know. I couldn't remember if it had been removed and was on display elsewhere or if it just had never been there. But I also feel compelled to comment this idea of the with the elites and this idea of treaties, because the first thing that came to my mind when I read that was that's how the Ten Commandments are understood. That the Ten Commandments are an example of this sort of vassal treaty between, a king and or a ruler and the people that are being ruled. And so I was very interested to see that that also appears in Mithraism and probably elsewhere too.
Yeah, indeed, the gods as such were a real presence in the lives of people. It's true to say that that continued well into the 12th century in Europe. Certainly here in Istanbul, as late as 13th century, people were manipulating the statues that Constantine had placed in the city in order to influence historical events. So we had all these pagan statues which were deemed to be infused with the daemones that they represented. And they had a huge influence over the fate of the city. So that if there was an invasion somewhere, knowing how to move the statues around, you could effectively change the course of history. And, this kind of, I can only describe it as animist worldview, persisted in Europe very, very late. I would say as late as the 18th century, personally. I think the secular or mechanistic mindset is a very late
All
newcomer
right.
on the scene.
I just set off the fire alarms.
Oh, wow, well done.
Bear with me one second, please.
No problem.
Sorry about that.
No problem.
Yeah, that's why I usually just burn a stick incense instead of the charcoal one, but oh well, we still have the aroma for the rest of the conversation. Yeah, let me figure out where. Oh, okay, so I think that maybe something we should do before getting any deeper into some of this material is address who Mithra was. For anyone who doesn't know, and my understanding, if I was reading this correctly, that there's connection to the Indo-European deity Mithra. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, we have attestations in the Indian subcontinent, in Persia, and in Anatolia dating back, I don't know, 2000 BC. So certainly Bronze Age. We can only account for this commonality, this Mithra, as a root by postulating it was part of Proto-Indo-European, the original language, which kind of has a geographic spread from Scandinavia to the middle of the Indian continent, So there's like 12 major branches of the Indo-European family tree. So you'll find these deep connections pointing back towards a Proto-Indo-European, which may have been in the steppes north of the Black Sea. There's various hypotheses where the homeland was. So that has led to a lot of confusion, with people saying, "Oh, it must have been a Persian deity," or people in the Hindu tradition saying, "Oh no, it must have been a Hindu deity." Of course, in Anatolia, we have this Hittite-Mitanni peace treaty signed around 1400 BCE, which cites Mitra, Indra, and Varuna as the peacekeepers of the between the Hittites and Mitanni. So it's you have to postulate Proto-Indo-European origin somewhere in Central Asia, maybe, as about the closest you're ever going to get to the origins of the god. But he seems to have the same qualities. So again, points to a common homeland. There's overseeing of compacts and communities and treaties and so on.
Okay. Yeah, I
Yeah.
think that there's this tendency often, many folks, and I think that we're getting away from this, to think of, that a deity emerges and just like free of any kind of cultural context. But
Yeah.
I think that the more we understand about what was happening in the ancient world is that it was just this flow of influence and communication, and that makes saying that, yes, this deity belongs to this specific time and place a little bit difficult because the categories are getting erased, as it were, or at
It's
least
very confusing,
permeable.
and also, like, you have these long distance trade routes, Anatolian obsidian, Baltic amber, Afghanistan, the lapis lazuli. Even by the Bronze Age, these were well-defined trade routes connecting both parts of the world, and really, once we run past the Bronze Age, even older, we're in the region where maybe Proto-Indo-European existed as a linguistic group, but certainly all the trade routes already existed. So, trade or common linguistic origins, it's a gamble, really, which one you want to accentuate.
And it's, the choosing which one to accentuate, but both are at play,
Yeah,
plus
I
other
like
forces
that.
as well.
Yeah.
Plus
And
other
also
forces.
the iconography is at play now, because we have this the Epic of Gilgamesh. There's an episode called The Bull of Heaven, and in that, Gilgamesh and Enkidu set out to kill the Bull of Heaven, who was causing havoc. And Enkidu says to Gilgamesh, "Grab him by the snout and stab him between the horns and the nape of the neck. And while you're doing that, I'll stand on his rear hoof." And that is exactly the Tauroctony, the bull killing scene, that features in every single betrayer throughout the empire. It's like the standard icon of the cult. But it dates, well, if the earliest instance we have of that in writing is 2000 BCE, it must have been part of the oral tradition for how many thousand years before it was written down? And we're really back in the Neolithic at that stage. Okay, so we're again now looking at Proto-Indo-European common or core iconography, not just language. And then it just persists for millennia after that.
Well, I appreciated the Gilgamesh reference because it brought to mind two things. One, I think that still on Gilgamesh, and this I believe is applicable to the iconography in Mithraism, is that it's after they kill the Bull of Heaven that the goddess Ishtar descends and essentially kind of proposes marriage to Gilgamesh. And I think it's Enkidu, his Gilgamesh's, wild buddy,
Sidekick, yeah.
takes the thigh bone of the Bull of Heaven and throws it at Ishtar. And that's one of the images that's in some of the Mithraic iconography, is this sort of leg or thigh bone, right? And that's also connected to the myth of Ishtar or Inanna going to the underworld where that's ruled over by her sister Eriskigal. I remember reading that one of the reasons that Eriskigal was so angry was that her husband was the bowl of heaven and kind of equated Ishtar or Inanna with the guilt of his death.
Of course, the thigh bone is a representation of the star constellation that circulates the whole star. Okay, so you see it like the Egyptian opening of the mouth ritual, by which they make something divine, utilizes an implement in that shape. The plow, the distinctive shape of the constellation. So that then becomes a symbol of eternity because it's always visible. And then you see Mithras wielding that in one of the scenes connected with the Turopton. So this notion of eternal life is kind of encoded within it. And we're also now at the kind of issue of what exactly or how exactly did this astral religion become such a defining feature of so many cultures across the world? It's like certain portions of the night sky have become indelibly stamped with a certain metaphysical and spiritual understanding. And that goes on pretty well to today. So it's the whole thing about the star religion as well, which, of course, the Turopton fits into that frame.
Yeah, because the one reading of the bowl on the Turoctony is that it is the sign of Taurus, and again that Mithras is associated with Perseus, which kind of follows that. But the imagery of the bowl is ancient. The earliest, I mean, it's in the cave, the Paleolithic cave walls, but also in one of the Paleolithic caves, the name's escaping me right now. The coffee's still kicking in, but there's a stalactite from inside the cave, and it has what they refer to as the Minotaur, and the bottom half seems to be a feminine body, and the top is more of a bull. And I know that in Anatolia, in the Neolithic city that they've excavated in Shilhtayoch, you have bull horns and
Set into the holes, absolutely.
So very, very,
Vast
very.
continuities of iconography and significance.
And I always like to point out, I mean, because there's this connection between the bull and usually a goddess, that we still have that in our modern astrology, where the sign of Taurus is ruled by Venus. So let's get into some of this iconography with the, we can start with the Taurotomy. So we've got Mithras killing the bull, and are there other meanings to this other than this sort of celestial interpretation?
Yeah, it's kind of polysemous. It's one of the things is of course, is that where he's stabbing the bull is the constellation, sub-constellation Pleiades. Indeed, the knife is also a sub-constellation within Taurus. And that you get this stream of meteors from this region of the sky during the summer, it's like
The
twice.
Perseids.
Perseids and then the Taurids pour out of that region of the sky, and they've always had this kind of aura of being a healing stream, somehow, life-sustaining effusion of astral energy. So yeah, there's all of that there, and that's carried down so that we need to look at the significance of the bull as a the moon is connected to Taurus as well. The moon is astrologically connected to Taurus, so that the moon is also the gateway by which souls enter incarnation. So that in a sense that the killing of the bull, therefore, is an attempt to reverse this process of metempsychosis. Okay, so that it has that kind of flavor that Mithras is a savior
Right.
savior of souls. And they call him as the person, the ox goad, the person who rounds up, so to speak, souls. Okay, so that's another sub astral layer, it's kind of metaphysical layer. And then you can say that the sequence of images whereby Mithras fights with the bull, kills it, carries it on his back, feasts off its skin on the as a banquet, represent personal qualities that Mithras, as the proto Mistei, the ideal initiate, exhibits, and which, if you want to become close to the deity, you would emulate, so to speak. So, courage, endurance, so on and so forth. And these are all recognizably male military qualities. You
Right.
find the same thing in any of the special forces around the world today. We'll tell you straight off, these are the qualities we are looking for in someone.
Yeah.
The Mithraic cult has that dimension as well. The people who are part of it, as you said, were largely military or connected with the military. They may have been in civil service, but most of them appear to have been serving officers and soldiers. So the kind of community that they're looking to build on the basis of a common stock of values are the same values that keep people alive in the front line, and therefore are kind of exemplary values for the prospective initiate who wants to be like Mithras, to approach the Godhead through emulating Mithras, let's say, needs to thoroughly have imbibed and embodied in their own life. So this is the emulation of the God. And this concept, you'll find it in every culture. It's the Imitatio Dei of the Christian faith, but its roots, you see it in Plato's Phaedrus, to aspire to become like the God as much as possible, or in the Vajrayana to embody the quality of the deity as far as possible. This is like the foundation stone for achieving some kind of spiritual union or mystical union with the deity. You need to reflect that deity morally and ethically in your own day-to-day life as far as you can.
Yeah, I had a interest in this because of I have a background in virtue theory, and so as soon as you have a whole chapter, on the arete, which is excellence, and Mithras is this sort of moral exemplar, if you will. But also, as you were speaking, I was thinking, because I ground a lot of my stuff in, I mean, I'm familiar with Plato, but I ground a lot of my virtue in Aristotle. And his argument is that, you want to be virtuous to achieve eudaimonia, which often is translated as happiness. Now it's flourishing, but I also think that there's a different reading. It's the good daimon. You want to be virtuous to get the good daimon, which seems to fit more into this initiatory experience of.
On an esoteric level, that is definitely the case. The kind of spiritual entities or beings on which the entire process of mystery rites is founded on requires that sympathetic engagement with other than human lines of spiritual evolution, let's say. So if you cannot make that accommodation, there's no reason why they should work with you. It's sine qua non. You have to have a sympathetic, empathetic relationship with them. And that also brings a bigger question, because if they have a spiritual trajectory, that is the work that they are engaged in, you need to align with that to be aligned with them. And so if the universe is unfolding in a teleological way towards a higher and higher levels of consciousness, then that is their primary work. And you are not their primary work, but you can piggyback on their primary work by aligning yourself with it. So again, this Imitatio Dei also has a strong evolutionary underpinning to it, in my reading at least.
Yeah, it's interesting because, as I mentioned earlier, the idea of these treaties, the vassal treaties, and I had said that, that's kind of what the Ten Commandments is modeled on. And there does seem to be a difference. I mean, you have the Ten Commandments are supposed to be moral, and but they're like rules that you just follow the commands. Whereas here, you become like the deity. You embody the various virtues rather than simply just following the commands of the deity.
And also, it's important that, this notion of Aretas has shifted from exhibiting certain qualities to embodying them within your own spiritual life. And that is a profound evolutionary shift in human spirituality.
Absolutely it is. So the Tauroctony is the most common or the best known, I should say, iconography for Mithras, but there are others that you look at in the book. And the one that I really wanted to talk about was Aeon or Phanes. Not sure I'm pronouncing Phanes right. I think I am. But I was wondering if you could discuss that a little bit because this is you refer to it as a time deity, and I think it also eventually gets connected to Saturn.
Okay, so in the Orphica, or the Orphic fragments, better to say, there's a cosmogenesis, which is different from Hesiod's Theogony, right? So there's a unique, specific Orphic account of the creation myth, which is far more metaphysical than what you find in the Theogony, which is all about this God begat that God and so on. But in the Orphic Theogony, if you like, or the Orphic cosmogenesis, you have this great serpent that gives birth to an egg, and the egg, under the pressure from within, it bursts open, and this deity Phanes, pure illumination is what his name indicates, emerges, right? So this is very much, for me, a condensation of the spiritual process of emergence within the Orphic tradition. Okay, so but it's kind of abstracted. The iconography takes it away from, as I say, we're dealing with an illiterate age. So the iconography has a way of capturing spiritual emergence in a way that we can see key elements. The serpent, for me, always indicates serpent power, which is a physiological experience of high levels of inner energy, and it's the prerequisite for enlightened awareness. So much of the work on physical or ethical purification is designed to free the energy body of its, so to speak, ancestral karma. And that cleansing process naturally activates the serpent energy. Okay. And then, through the providential outreach of a deity, full emergence into the awareness of a deity becomes possible. Now, this is a gross simplification of a very complex process. I mean, if you read any of the Vajrayana literature on the energy body, it's immensely complicated. But in outline, this is what the iconography is saying to us. And that emergence is back into the Golden Age, again, as a metaphor for non-dual awareness. It's beyond curve. It's complete immersion. And that's what Phanes represents, pure illumined awareness. And so it's totally implicated with the time deity. Whether the time deity is Kalachakra or Saturn or Cronus or some other deity from the Indian tradition, doesn't matter. It's Amon as well, Amun Ra. It's the time deity was timeless and exists in the space of timelessness, in which all time is kind of co-present. Okay, so again, this is a metaphor for the state of awareness that the cult should lead you towards at the supreme point of initiation. And it's doubtful whether you can ever hold on to a state like this for any sustained period of time. I always think of it as a momentary illumination, but an illumination which fundamentally changes your life going forward, because you can't see anything the same as what you saw beforehand.
Right. Yeah.
Especially life and death, the two great issues are fundamentally recontextualized.
Yeah. The eyes are opened, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I like that. I found it really interesting that you commented on this, because I think probably what's going on with some of my listeners or viewers is when they're hearing this discussion about the serpent and serpent energy, they're going like, ooh, 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 Kundalini. And that's true. And but what I liked was that you made the point that this appears everywhere, not so much because of the interactions of cultures or, the spread of ideas along trade routes, but because it is part of kind of human, I don't necessarily want to say physiology, but the human experience, that this is something that is just experienced throughout. So it wasn't that this idea was being shared, but that this was being experienced.
Yeah. We have so many accounts of Kundalini rising. So many. There's no mistaking the phenomena, nor mistaking the results of the fully risen Kundalini in terms of conscious awareness, but also no mistaking the dangers involved with prematurely awakening this power. And again, I think it was a big part that the mysteries played for in this process was in regulating its emergence. So instead of somebody just kind of going off and doing a series of practices and then having some unfortunate results, the mystery cult was sufficiently well bounded in terms of its ritual process, its experience, to contain and guide that process to its fulfillment. And I think this is the great loss that the suppression of the mystery cults in the 4th century CE, a great loss to human spiritual evolution that occurred then.
So the mystery cults sort of acted like a guru, the equivalent of a
Yeah.
guru in the
Well,
Indian
the
and Tibetan
lineage,
traditions.
they were lineage. So, within a family tradition, there's a discipline set up necessary to retain the connection to the deity. Just as, the Dalai Lama, for instance, retains a connection to the initiation traditions that he carries. So it's a huge commitment. It's a lifetime commitment to refrain from certain activities, certain foods, certain behaviors, and to daily, so to speak, refresh the connection with the deity. It's not a, just a, you know. It's not just when the mystery rite comes around, you okay, well, get your robes on and go. No, it's a daily practice. So really, the mysteries are a dimension of devotional religiosity, but unlike religion, it's not doctrinal. It's what they call imagistic. So there's not a body of or canon of texts. There's not a priesthood that says it has to be like this. However it is for you, it is how it was meant to be. It's imagistic. It's your own experience that's absolutely counts for everything. And that's a vital distinction to make. The mysteries were not a mystery religion as such, in the way that we understand the other religions.
And using the term religion, it seems to me to be possibly also an instance of forcing something into a category that it doesn't necessarily belong into, because, I also see this connection. You've mentioned the Neoplatonist and Plato, and we currently have this strict sort of boundary between what's philosophy and what's religion, but I don't think that the ancient folks necessarily had that. And
But
there
Plato
was,
certainly didn't have that.
Yeah, Plato, but I was also, I mean, you talk about Plato's allegory of the chariot, but also what came to mind was, I think it was Parmenides, who had this sort of visionary experience of talking to a goddess, and he ascends to the upper realm in a chariot, I
The
think.
Myth of Ara, your 10th book of the
Yeah,
Republic,
right.
and the entirety of Timaeus, the entirety of Phaedrus, and he even uses expressions like you can't grasp the core, which is the core, the creative matrix in the Timaeus. He
Yeah.
says you can't grasp it except by a kind of bastard thinking. So he's actually proposing an irrational mode of understanding. And again, we come back to the mysteries as something which is unspeakable. It goes beyond the bounds of rationality. But for a long time now, Plato has been subjected to a very kind of dualistic understanding in Western academic circles which have tended to not really value the more mystical aspects of his text, even though they're woven through.
Yeah.
It hasn't been very palatable to certainly the kind of Anglo-American philosophy I study. I did
Yeah.
3 years of formal logic,
Yeah.
philosophy of science,
Oh,
epistemology, you name it.
yeah.
It
Yeah.
was there was not
Yeah.
Plato was not going to get a sympathetic full
Right.
reading in that
Yeah.
context. Analytic
Yeah.
philosophy is kind of the antithesis of all
Yeah,
that
no,
stuff.
I share that background. My undergraduate degree was in philosophy, and I've often, when I teach, I would always say, well, Plato is kind of a mystic here. I mean, Plato is a mystic, but that's as far as I could take it. But it's a very different thing when you approach philosophy as an initiatory experience, and that the Neoplatonists had this idea of theurgy, which I think is part of what we're talking about. A theurgy, I always understand it as God making, but it seems to be very similar to what you're talking about in terms of the mysteries, that you
Absolutely. I mean,
act in a way.
the Phaedrus absolutely encompasses all of this.
So the mystery traditions ended essentially, right? Yeah, I think you said 4th or 5th century of the Common Era. That's because of the kind of the fall of Rome, but also the advance of Christianity. But there
Well,
was this.
let me just answer that and make it, I could just put kind of frame on it. What I understood is, as you said, fall of Rome, and then the attempt to re-establish the Roman Empire by Justinian in the early 6th century. And to do so by, first of all, he hammered all of the alternative Christianities. There were so many of them. They were targeted right from the outset, and any remnants of the pagan cults were also systematically destroyed at that point. So really, Justinian was the pivotal, and what he created, of course, was Orthodox Christianity. And that was to attempt to pull together, because in Damascus, Hilary, Alexandria, they had these archbishops, and they all had a different brand or flavor of Christianity that they held fast to. So the only way to reunify the empire was to have a conformity of belief. And then he expended most of the empire's wealth on one war after the other. And he did briefly reunite the empire largely, but that was it then. So much had been lost. It could, and they had a plague. They had Justinian's plague, killed how many people? And all in all, it was a done deal. We entered the Dark Ages pretty quickly then.
Yeah, and when you talk about the kind of the diversity, you use the plural of Christianities, which I always try to do as well. But part of that too is the Gnostics, and there's this Gnostic, I don't know, Gnostic thread or aspect is probably a better word to these mysteries. And this, I think, also goes back to Plato and the Timaeus, where this idea of demiurge, that I think Saturn maybe played a part of is the Demiurge. It's not quite as the seen as being as bad and nasty as the Gnostic Demiurge, but it is this sort of creator being, if I understand correctly.
Yeah, in Plato, there's a creator being that's part of the metaphor for the creation. This is in the Timaeus, by the way, isn't it? Largely, which is purports to be an account of a Pythagorean who gave a lecture in Athens that Plato is, I don't know, is it truly Pythagorean doctrine, or is it Plato's idea of Pythagorean, or is it Plato's ideas with a Pythagorean kind of shell given to it? We don't know. But essentially, yeah, the Demiurge plays a very large role in that process. So you're now at the kind of borderline between classical mythology and modern kind of metaphysical thinking, and there's kind of overlap there. So how are we to take the Demiurge exactly? It gets really problem. Once you step out of mythology or mythological speaking, it gets really difficult to, are we to give ontological significance to these figures, or are they purely metaphysical metaphors, so to speak?
Well, I have a Gnostic turpitude, so I tend to think of the Demiurge and
One thing on Gnosticism, though, is, and I think this is something which kind of casts a bit of a shadow in the game of Saturn, is that I didn't clearly distinguish in that word between Gnostic dualism in the sense of a absolute metaphysical evil and an absolute metaphysical good. That kind of Gnosticism is very much foreign to the Hellenistic tradition of Plato and certainly the school of Athens, Proclus and Damasius and all of those key thinkers, seminal thinkers. So it's kind of a late, what would you call it, reemergence of a trend within the Gnostic cults, which leads to this figure of Satan ultimately. So again, that's kind of fork in the road. If you accept the existence of metaphysical evil, then that's one interpretation of Gnosticism. But if you don't, then you have to look at the light aspects of it as a path towards transcending material bondage, which is back to Phaedrus again. So yeah, there's a big fork in the road. That's
For
at that
sure.
point, yeah.
Well, my Gnostic turpitude is that the archons are all bureaucrats and keeping us, mindless rules, So there is this kind of rebirth. You mentioned an early renaissance of some of this thinking. And I think this leads into the game of Saturn and the Sola Busca Tarot. And we don't need to linger on this too long. I found it fascinating. Mostly it began because I have a love of tarot, but Sola Busca is completely different than any other tarot deck. And what you're argument was is that the imagery in there is of it's a mystery tradition, and
Surgical ritual. It's like buried under like three layers at least of imagery. But the presence of George Gemistus, or also known as Platon, in the Renaissance cities, 1438 to 1440, 1441, that period was an incredibly influential figure. He was the age's greatest living authority on Plato. He was a political advisor to the Byzantine emperor and his son. He had wrote a complete pagan liturgy based on the traditional Hellenic gods. And he was busy proselytizing for a rejection of Christianity and a reversion to Hellenism. So you put all those together, and he's still brought over as part of the Byzantine delegation to attempt the unification of the Western and Eastern churches. It's kind of bizarre that you would even bring a person like this. But one of his leading students was, of course, Bessarion, who was the Archbishop of Nicaea, and came across to Italy with the Byzantine delegation and was offered and made a cardinal of the church. And he was Platon's closest friend and closest student. So you see this kind of intermingling now of a resurgent Hellenism into the Italian Renaissance elite families. And not only that, of course, the Italian Renaissance elite families were also the cardinals of the church.
Right.
There was no separation. There was, Ercole d'Este of Ferrara, under whom the cards were made. His son was cardinal in the church. I mean, you can't kind of separate the threads anymore. So you have this like hidden stream of pagan and Hellenistic metaphysics and ritual practice now penetrating the Italian elite circles. And that's, I believe, is what we see mirrored in the Sola Vasca.
Okay.
The ritual process for invoking the god Cronos, Saturn, or Amun into the ruler, just as Alexander the Great claimed to have been the son of Amun, which was the kind of claim in the popular Alexander romance literature. If you need to be a successful ruler, therefore, why not Alexander? Sorry, throat.
My understanding, though, is that, or at least what's coming to mind, is that there's still that idea of the virtues at play. They appear in the cards as well, right?
What which ones were you thinking of? I do
Well,
recognize the cosmological
yeah.
part
Well,
of the
yeah, and I think that maybe my question is coming a little bit more from the not Sola Vusca, because I'm not quite as
Certainly
familiar
from
with that
Carlo
desk.
Damasio. Yeah, Carlo
Yeah,
Damasio,
yeah,
definitely.
yeah. Because we
Based
have,
on the five virtues.
courage, temperance,
Yeah,
justice.
yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So this is where we reference Christophe Poncet's recent work, The Tarot of Marsilio. It's going to be a three volume. First volume is out. It's published by Scarlet Imprint. And we made a kind of prelude to this. We came together for a long conversation on the esoteric in the tarot, which is published as Two Esoteric Tarots by Scarlet Imprint. And that counts, brings together the Tarot de Marseille style and the Sola Vasca style. And so we bring them into alignment with each other. And so the Tarot of Marseille is based on Marsilio Ficino's reading of Plato's Phaedrus, in other words. Okay. And it was almost certainly designed by Botticelli. Okay, so Christophe Poncet has gone into great depth and detail on the iconography of TVM and its origins. So it's interesting that the two major strands in tarot iconography are both rooted in a resurgent Hellenism. The Sola Vasca in its ritual or its praxis, and the Tarot de Marseille in its metaphysics.
Okay.
And as you know, the Phaedrus addresses that central question, is how, given our natural drives and desires, is the spiritual life even possible? And so the whole of the Phaedrus is really an account of how, by withdrawing our awareness from the contemplation of beauty back to the source of beauty, which is perceived between lives, we can begin a process of spiritual rehabilitation. Anyway, that's
Okay. No, thank you for that. That's perfect. Now, and I saw the Two Esoteric Tarot on your website, so I'm now going to have to read that. So the Sola Vusca, does it then, if that's more of the metaphysics, does
Practice,
it con oh, the practice, excuse me.
yeah, it's the ritual
So,
practice.
okay, so the practice, so the ritual, so it would be like the mysteries.
Essentially, it's a liturgic ritual. Yeah, it's
Okay.
depicted in those cards. Yeah.
All right. And so the cards, just like in the iconography of Mithraism, they're kind of showing people how, or at least the elite, how to undergo these rituals?
Exactly.
Okay.
It gives the ritual postures, gestures, gives the ritual implements, it gives the process, the longer process, and it gives all of the inputs, which are
Okay.
largely astral, like certain constellations, certain fixed stars, and certain planets. And it's a two-phase ritual. They first of all draw down the astral, so to speak, powers, energies into a substance. Okay? And then they sacrifice that substance, which is in effect a homunculus, according to Renaissance logic. It's now an artificial life. They sacrifice that to Saturn. And on the back of that, they then invoke Saturn, Cronus, Amun to possess the operator, so that they're, so to speak, fully engaged with that energy. And that's the ritual process that's kind of buried deep in the iconography. On top of that, they've overlain various things. One is like historical narratives.
Right, right.
There's other strange stuff in there, like references to Nimrod and Tower,
Right, right.
which are not from the Bible. It's not Genesis. They've gone to the Book of the Watchers
Right.
for that imagery. And the historical cards are drawn from Livy, Orosius, Plutarch, a most incredible range of classical sources. But they're kind of beneath the historical references, there are small clues given that are not accounted for by the historical reference. And those clues in the cards are like trapdoor, allow you to drop through to the next layer. I don't know if you've seen that film, The Ninth Gate,
Many, many, many
Johnny
years
Depp.
ago.
Yeah? You
Yeah,
remember
many
the
years ago.
hook in that?
No, I don't remember much of any of it. I'm going to have to
Well,
rewatch it.
he's chasing these grimoires, each one of which has an image on how to conduct a ritual. Okay, so the people who are pursuing him are getting to the grimoires before him and extracting that page, but
Okay.
they're putting together all the correct ones to conduct the ritual. The solar busker is kind of like that, except it's real.
Yeah, so it's a grimoire.
It's a grimoire, absolutely. Grimoire of Hellenistic surgical invocation via an alchemical operation.
Yeah, and the alchemy, I had that written down in my as you were talking, especially with the homunculus, because I always relate that to an alchemical process.
Absolutely. And
Yeah,
the
and
ritual draw it down is the drawing down the moon, which is
yeah.
attested from like 700 BCE in Babylonian texts. And occurs again in like Aristophanes' Comedies, talks about drawing down the moon. And again, Medea draws down the moon. So that by carefully selecting certain celestial objects and getting the timing right, you can draw them down into a menstruum through a ritual, which is the drawing down of the moon ritual. And having done so, you've created the, let me tell you that they use sexual fluids as the menstruum, it's semen and menses. So that becomes imbued with certain astral qualities that define the homunculus as having a character which is sympathetic with the deity that they wish to invoke. So it's Martian and Mercury, those kind of planetary energies, and certain constellations like Algol, the fixed star within the Medusa head, which is part of the Perseus constellation. That's also used. So it's what most modern astrologers were saying was fairly malefic. But when we say malefic, it's on the power end of the spectrum of love. Okay, it's like, if love is one way, this is the power end of things. And very much the solar busker is in that domain. Whereas the Tarot de Marseille's metaphysics, as I say, is underlaid by the Phaedrus. It's very much about love. The solar busker is very much about power, real power, and how to wield power.
All right. So it's almost with the invocation of the planetary energies, it's well, we refer to it as grimoire, so it's magical. So in a way, it's an attempt to, and I hopefully I'm not wrong here, but it's an attempt to kind of counter what may be fated in order to use the energies to have some.
This is an interesting question now, because one of the recurrent sets of words throughout the Solar Buster is this, like a banner saying, Trahul Fatis, I am driven by fate. And if we look at Gemistos Platon's ideology, he says everything is fate. Okay, because the ruler of this world is this deity, Saturn, Cronus, Amun. So there's a real question about what latitude he, in his metaphysics, gives to freedom. It's a big question with him. He's almost totally fateful. And the cards seem to reflect that point of view. I am driven by fate is kind of spoken again and again. So if you're going to be driven by fate again, why not align yourself with the most powerful forces possible? That gives you the greatest amplitude of choice.
Okay. Yeah, so
So,
there's.
this is a very, I don't know how to describe it. You're like on a razor edge here in terms of, where's this going exactly? What is this power being accumulated for? And how is it going to be used? It begins to take on sinister overtones for a lot of people. On the other hand, if you look at the historical context, small city-state of Ferrara invaded by Venice, has one third of its land stripped off, its crops destroyed. They have to borrow massively just to feed the population. As the duke of this small territory, it's you're absolutely incumbent upon you to solve these problems, because the people under you are like an extended family. And that kind of gives you a warrant, doesn't it, to assemble or accumulate as much and exert as much counter pressure as you possibly can for survival. And again, most of us are not in a situation of life where these kind of things have to be thought about and acted on. But for some people in the world, they are. And this is why I understand the solar basket in its context. But out of its context, it looks like, it's.
Yeah, well, I've got a copy of the Sola Busca, which I purchased after hearing, I think, an interview with you and Gordon White on Rune Soup. And that's
That's
also when I
published a
picked
while
up.
ago, wasn't
Yeah, it's been a
it?
long time. But that's also when I ordered the copy of the Game of Saturn. I had to have it shipped from the UK, but it was worth it for me. But yeah, in the Sola Busca I've got, there's a guidebook that tries to force everything into like a traditional tarot. And I'm like, no, that's not how this
Just
is
doesn't
supposed to
go.
be read. Yeah. So there's, I guess, the question I have, and I know that I'm keeping you here, so we'll wrap this up here in a few minutes. But there's not any of the sort of the Orphic tenets in this that are common to the mystery traditions, like the metempsychosis, the really, I mean, there's a little bit of the embodying of the gods,
In
but
the
there's
Solar
not,
Buster, you mean?
yeah.
No, it's definitely all founded on metempsychosis. In fact,
Okay.
it's a kind of warlike orphism.
Okay.
There's even the torchbearers from the Mithraic mysteries are
Right.
represented in the
Right.
Solar Buster. There's a Deo Toro, which who was a Deo Taurus was a historical figure, but the way they spell it, Dio Toro, separated, it's quite. It's a reference to and then
Okay.
Perseus is definitely represented, as is
Yeah.
the sub-constellation Medusa and the fixed star Algol.
Right. Okay.
So there's a whole cluster of Mithraic
Yeah.
references in the
Okay.
Solar Buster, and that
Right.
connects it firmly to Mithraism, but also to Orphism, which is
Okay.
interesting. But I say this is the power end of these human scale of
Yeah.
emotion.
Right.
It's not the lovey-dovey
Right.
stuff of the TDM, which is
Okay.
more characteristic of Ficino, its
Right.
concentration, beauty. as a thing in itself,
All
and
right.
using beauty as a path to spiritual evolution. That's really, everyone can get on board with that. It's all about a bit harder.
Okay, good. Well, that clarifies for me because that was the question is like, well, where's the connection between the Mithraic and the Sola Musca? And I knew that there was.
Yeah, it's there.
So
It's an
it's
extraordinary.
just altered form a little bit.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's disguised, very subtly disguised. Yeah.
And all of this is representative of this the Renaissance and the rebirth, and then it just it feeds into this Western esoteric tradition.
Yeah, I think there's a book which will become available this month. It's by Peter Gray, who's one of the two owners and publishers of Scholar in Print. And it's the second volume of his study of Lucifer and the Luciferian tradition. And it's very interesting. It's Lucifer Praxis. And in that book, he connects the fallen angel mythos with the wider mythos going back into Babylonia and forward to the Romantic poets. Okay, so he establishes a kind of underlying or esoteric continuity, which is not apparent when you view esoteric history in terms of like the Rosicrucian manifestos and then Castiglione and then the emergence of Golden Dawn. This standard like narrative, which purports to be the history of Western esotericism, is in fact a kind of shell. It's not essential in the way it should be, and that's what Peter Gray is reestablishing. So he traces it through the mythos of the Watchers, right through into almost into modern times, via this Luciferian current as a current of personal and societal liberation. That's a very profound and beautiful book he's written. And I'm writing a review of it currently. So I say it's not out yet. It'll be out by the end of the month, hopefully early September. But that is going to be one of the classic texts. He wrote Apocalyptic Witchcraft, Peter Gray. And that is an absolute classic in the reframing of the witchcraft tradition. And this one is going to be a major work, really, in the deep history of the esoteric cult, especially in its Western manifestation. So, really looking forward to that.
I'll have to look into that. And it's I remember that you had a statement. I think it was in this one. I don't think I'm confusing the current book with the Game of Saturn, but and this is a different conversation, so we don't have to go down this track. But I remember you the statement was that the idea of the Watchers, which is found in the books of Enoch, you said that this is really foundational for the esoteric tradition.
Yeah, in a sense, it's the earliest emergence myth, let's say, that we have. But on a more profound level, if you think about the way in which esoteric effectiveness is actually realized, it is a process whereby the operator and a different life stream, a different evolutionary life stream combine to make something possible or make something happen. Again, this is the most primitive, like voodoo, the possession cult. It's always the human other than human combination that is at the core, of esoteric practice. And that combination can be seen as eros, as that indefinable otherness of being, which is the essential prerequisite for efficacy, for esoteric efficacy. So the mythos of the Watchers is essentially the intercourse of these fallen angels and human women. But what is actually under the surface there is the rousing of the current of Eros sufficiently to attract an otherworldly interest. The otherworldly interest is neither male nor female, it's otherworldly. It's essentially the other.
Yeah, and
So,
you end the current book with Eros and Psyche.
yeah,
So,
indeed. Yeah, there's another, great way of expressing how the mystical and the magical are potentialized through this connection. So it doesn't matter which tradition you're looking at, to the extent that it's efficacious, that it works, you're going to see this fundamental mechanism at play. And
Okay.
that's the essence of Peter Gray's argument there, and he's right. This is totally is.
Yeah. Well, I know that I've kept you, and it's later in the day where you are. I'm just beginning my day. I think the coffee's finally kicked in. So I don't want to
Yes,
keep you
I think
any.
so, right?
Yeah. Well, I could talk to you for a lot longer, but I find this all very fascinating, and I really appreciate the work that you've done, not just because I have this abiding interest in the mystery traditions and also philosophy, but I think it's recovering some knowledge that has been lost to us,
Absolutely.
that I think is vital as we move forward. So let me ask you the final questions I always ask. What do you have coming up next? What are you working on, other than the review of Peter Gray's new book?
Okay, I think by the time this comes out, a certain time will have passed. So in October, I'm at Occultur in
Okay.
Berlin.
Okay.
What I'm doing for that is taking the original archaeological descriptions of the ritual process from the Capua Vetere, Mithraea, descriptions of the frescoes, the ritual frescoes there, which appear in the book. But as you can see yourself, they're terribly degraded now. Those photographs were taken in 1960. So you can imagine how those frescoes are now. So apart from the archaeologist's original description of the frescoes, they're pretty well lost. So I'm taking that description and using AI to regenerate the ritual action.
Okay.
And I'm going to attempt to put that up on the big screen of Occultur in Berlin, 23rd, 26th October. So that's a major event in the European calendar. And I think just about every significant esotericist is present in the
Okay.
issue. And then in December, I'll do a kind of gig with the Tarot Association of Barcelona, but that will be a lecture, probably online rather than in person. And I hope that'll be broadcast more widely. And they've asked me to lecture on the solar buskin.
Okay.
So, but on top of that, I've got a ton of material for each of my books, interviews on the YouTube channel, on my YouTube channel. It's all just accessible, freely accessible. I've got a website, but it's more like a static brochure. And I've got a Patreon account now in which a lot of stuff which has been written but not published, book reviews, all kinds of stuff is over there on the Patreon. And I continue to update that with fresh material. So it's more of a community to follow my thinking, what I'm doing. But I have like 10 to 12 projects running
Okay.
simultaneously, usually.
Yeah. What's the Patreon address? Is it
It's
patreon.com?
Peter Mark Adams. That's what,
Okay.
just Google it, or
All right.
Google
All
my name,
right.
it'll pop out.
Yeah. And the same for YouTube? Is it?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. All
It's
right. Well, I'll
Peter
put the
Mark.
links. I don't know if I can get the YouTube channel on there when I post on YouTube, but I'll definitely elsewhere on the audio platforms, I'll get the
Yeah.
YouTube link and the Patreon and your website and a link to the Ritual and Epiphany and the Mysteries of Mithras. I know that that is published. There's a limited publication for that, I understand.
Yeah, there will be. They're selling well. Don't know
Yeah.
how long it'll last. Let's
Okay.
see.
Yeah. Well, definitely get this out before the October Occulture
Bye.
conference. And yeah. So, Peter, thank you so much for your time today. I
It's been a
thoroughly
pleasure,
enjoyed the
Nick.
conversation. And like I
Yeah.
said, it's been an honor because I just love your work.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure talking to you, Nick. I look forward to another time, huh?
Yeah, I'd love to. I'd
Let's
love
do
to reconnect.
it
Yeah,
again.
absolutely, absolutely. And that's a wrap on episode 201 of Rebel Spirit Radio. Thank you so much for listening or watching if you are part of my YouTube audience. As always, if you enjoyed this episode, please hit that like button if you're watching on YouTube, and don't forget to subscribe to the channel and click that notification bell. You can also follow Rebel Spirit Radio on whatever audio platform you use for listening to podcasts. Right now, I have over 20,000 downloads on the audio platforms, yet I only have 13 followers, and one of those is me. It only takes a second to like, follow, or subscribe. It's totally free, and it really does help. Putting together this podcast is a labor of love. I do love it, but it's also a lot of labor. So if you find value in the conversations I provide here, I hope you can find it in your heart to send a little love my way. With more subscribers and followers, I could possibly get some sponsorship and, honestly, having some funds come my way to help with equipment, hosting, and other necessary subscriptions would be really helpful. You can also help by joining my Patreon at patreon.com/rebelspirit. The link is also in the episode description. You can also buy a Super Thanks on YouTube to help support my work. So I always like to say I'm here on the front range now doing missionary work in regards to religion, spirituality and ecology, consciousness, the esoteric, and how all of this can help us heal humanity's sacred relationship with the living earth. So if you feel moved by the rebel spirit, and you know, I sure hope that you do, then please, by all means, help me in my efforts to share the good news. I'm Nick Mather, and you've been listening to or watching Rebel Spirit Radio. Until next time, may you be in peace, may you flourish in all possible ways, and may you continue to nurture your rebel spirit.